What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at USPS.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I am Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
We touched really, really, really briefly on today's topic way back when we did our condensed history of Rhodesia. It is Great Zimbabwe, which is a huge stone city in what's now southeastern Zimbabwe, and it's been on my to-do list for that entire time. We also recently, I'm not quite sure if the letters were from the same person or if people were just copying and pasting the same text, but we got multiple identical requests for it.
There you go.
From different email addresses. So I moved up the list after that. In a way, Great Zimbabwe has multiple histories. Obviously, there is the history of its founding and its construction and the people who originally lived there. But then there's also this completely separate and 100% incorrect history that European explorers and colonists sort of bestowed upon it. And this was a history that insisted that Great Zimbabwe in southeastern Africa had not been built by Africans. So today, we're going to talk about the site itself and how, what we know about its construction and who lived there. And then we're also going to talk about these first colonial histories that were written about it and how they were so colossally wrong, and the damage that came from that.
Great Zimbabwe, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, was most likely inhabited all the way back to the year 100. But from the 11th to the 15th centuries, it was a large, thriving city. And the word Zimbabwe means the house in stone, though it's also sometimes translated as sacred house or royal house. The descriptor of great distinguishes Great Zimbabwe from smaller stone cities in the area. It's one of about 150 major stone ruin sites in Zimbabwe and Mozambique.
There is some debate about exactly which sub-Saharan African people built Great Zimbabwe. The most commonly cited are the Shona, who were a Bantu-speaking people who migrated into the area from the Sahara Desert sometime around the 9th century. The Shona people still exist today, with a population of between 10 and 13 million, living primarily in Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Botswana, Zambia, and the northern parts of South Africa. There are multiple cultural groups and dialects of the Shona language within this population. Although Great Zimbabwe itself is a ruin now, Shona people still living in the area do view it as a sacred site and use it for spiritual purposes.
But there are other Bantu-speaking people suggested as Great Zimbabwe's builders as well, including the Venda and the Lemba. Lemba burial traditions are similar to those practiced at Great Zimbabwe. And they were also known for being traders, and Great Zimbabwe was an active trading hub. Even so, the Shona are the most commonly cited, and in many discussions of Great Zimbabwe, they're actually the only people that get mentioned.
The Great Zimbabwe ruins, as they exist today, are roughly described in three areas. There are the hill ruins or the hill complex, the Great Enclosure, and the valley ruins or valley complex. The hill ruins are along a very steep hill that rises 262 feet, which is about 80 meters, above the surrounding landscape. The hill ruins were home to Great Zimbabwe's ruling class, and through archaeological evidence, we know that the hill ruins were occupied pretty much continually from the 11th to the 15th centuries.
The hill ruins were basically a royal city, built from both shaped granite blocks and natural boulders. Regardless of which was used, they were built without mortar, and very narrow, sometimes covered passageways connected the different structures.
Two walled enclosures, which are both pretty large, are part of the hill ruins. The west enclosure was most likely where the chiefs lived. The east enclosure's purpose is a little bit less clear, although excavations revealed that it contained a collection of soapstone posts about a meter tall, all topped with carvings of birds. So it clearly had some kind of specific purpose. It might have been religious or ceremonial. And these soapstone birds are now known as Zimbabwe birds, and they're represented on Zimbabwe's flag. And also, many smaller versions of these birds have been found on the site as well.
Also part of the hill ruins is a shallow cave that was probably reserved for the use of the king. In addition to providing shelter and a view of the surrounding countryside, the shape of the cave and the surrounding hills basically creates a natural PA system. So a shout from the cave would echo from the hills and be audible by anyone in Great Zimbabwe.
The Great Enclosure, which lies to the south of the hill ruins, is the largest ancient structure in sub-Saharan Africa. It probably served one of two purposes. It was either the royal residence or a temple. So if the Great Enclosure was the royal residence, then the hill ruins were sort of the greater royal city where other people in the ruling class lived, but not necessarily the king and his immediate family.
The Great Enclosure itself is encircled by a huge elliptical wall that runs for 820 feet, that's about 250 meters, in places flanked by an inner parallel wall. And the walls are made of granite blocks, and they're quite tall. The Great Wall is 36 feet, which is 11 meters-ish at the tallest. And these walls aren't squared off or rectangular at all, they're actually a series of curves.
The builders of Great Zimbabwe built these curving walls out of square and rectangular granite blocks. The granite slabs that are part of the area's natural landscape split along straight lines when you break them, which made it possible to shape them into these regularly shaped square or rectangular forms. These walls were built in curves by placing the blocks one on top of the other and positioned so that the wall itself would have a slight inward slope that would help keep it stable.
Even though these walls look quite imposing, it's likely that they were built as a show of strength, not as an active defense. Regardless of their purpose, though, they're a true feat of craftsmanship and engineering.
Within the Great Enclosure are smaller walls separating the living areas for different families, and most of these areas include two living huts, a kitchen, and a common area.
One of the most distinctive features of the Great Enclosure, besides that enormous and impressive encircling wall, is a large conical tower. And its purpose is unknown, but it resembles a grain bin. It's thought to have had a religious or possibly symbolic purpose.
At both the hill ruins and the Great Enclosure, there are smaller structures, like living quarters, that were made from daga. Daga is a type of earthen brick made from granite sand and clay. Originally, the daga structures might have been almost imposing as the stone walls are, but because they were made of clay instead of stone, they've been subject to a lot more weathering and decay over the centuries that have passed since they were built. Today, most of the daga structures have been reduced down to mounds rather than being recognizable as what they were originally built to be.
The Valley Ruins, as their name suggests, stretch out through the valley. They're newer than the rest of Great Zimbabwe, with some of the structures dating as recently as the 19th century. And these new structures are brick rather than stone blocks. The Valley Ruins would have been home to Great Zimbabwe's citizens, with the Great Enclosure and the Hill Complex reserved for the royalty and upper social class.
From the 11th to the 15th century, Great Zimbabwe was an active, thriving, functioning city with a population of up to 18,000 people, making it the largest city in southern Africa at the time. Its artisans and craftspeople were particularly skilled at both stonework and making pottery. Many of the artifacts at the site were carved soapstone, like small statues, figures, decorated bowls, things like that. It was also an agricultural society, cultivating crops and raising cattle, both for food and as a symbol of the ruling class's wealth.
In addition, Great Zimbabwe, as we mentioned before, was a huge trading hub, in part because it was positioned between gold mines and the coast. Archaeologists have found beads, porcelain, glassware, and other materials that came from China, Persia, and India there. There are also coins from the Arab world, so the trading network moving through Great Zimbabwe was enormous, and it extended far beyond southern Africa.
Eventually, Great Zimbabwe's residents moved, and we will talk about when and why that happened and what happened afterward after a quick sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So in the late 15th century, Great Zimbabwe was abandoned, at least in terms of a society of people continually living there. Over the course of the city's history, the area around it had been deforested, and eventually there wasn't enough food available to continue to support its population. The direction of trade had also shifted a little to the north, which left Great Zimbabwe out of a lot of the most commonly used trading routes. A series of civil wars in the area may also have prompted people to relocate as well. So while most or all of Great Zimbabwe's population did relocate, it did continue also to be an important site culturally from a spiritual and a cultural perspective.
Many of Great Zimbabwe's population relocated to the city of Kami. And the Kami ruins also still exist in Zimbabwe. Like Great Zimbabwe, they are a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Because so many of Great Zimbabwe's residents moved to Kami, Kami's construction and layout have some similarities to Great Zimbabwe's. The same is true for pottery that was made at Kami. It follows a lot of the same techniques as earlier work at Great Zimbabwe. And Kami is basically a later creation of the same culture that built Great Zimbabwe, and it's the second largest stone monument in Zimbabwe after Great Zimbabwe.
Europeans started hearing about Great Zimbabwe in the 16th century. One of those first sources was João de Barro, who was a Portuguese historian who chronicled Portugal's history in Southeast Africa and parts of Asia. He wrote of, quote, a square fortress, masonry within and without, built of stones of marvelous size, and there appears to be no mortar joining them. And even though he says the word square, which Great Zimbabwe is definitely not square, This is usually interpreted as being about Great Zimbabwe, probably based on a description that someone gave to him, not something he had visited himself.
Word of this wonder started to spread, mostly through trading ports in Mozambique. De Barro and others who heard about Great Zimbabwe suspected that it was an important historical site, but they thought it was probably Ophir, the site of King Solomon's mines.
Soon, among European people who were interested in such things, it became basically common knowledge that somewhere in southeastern Africa were biblical ruins. So in 1871, German Karl Mauch set out on an expedition that he hoped would reveal the site of Ophir. In August of that year, he met up with a German trader who described, quote, quite large ruins which could never have been built by blacks. Mauch hired a local guide and then reached Zimbabwe on September 5th of that year, becoming at that point the first European known to have actually visited the site.
While exploring the ruins, he found some reddish, fragrant wood that resembled the wood of his pencil, and he concluded that it was cedar imported from Lebanon and that it was an import brought to the area by the Phoenicians, who he thought must have built the site for the Queen of Sheba.
It was really sandalwood. Not what he thought it was.
just one poorly identified piece of wood really steered things completely off course.
Yeah, his theories that Great Zimbabwe was built by the Phoenicians and had been home to the Queen of Sheba captured the attention of Cecil Rhodes, who we talk about a lot in our past podcast on Rhodesia. Rhodes's views were unquestionably steeped in white supremacy, so when he went to visit the ruins himself in the late 19th century, it was described as, quote, the ancient temple which once upon a time belonged to white men.
Rhodes and the British South Africa Company then enlisted J. Theodore Bent to investigate. Bent had an interest in the subject, but no formal training. And like Rhodes and Mauch, approached the task from the point of view that this city had to have been built by white men. He visited Great Zimbabwe with his wife and a man named Robert Swan, who acted as a cartographer.
Before even getting to Great Zimbabwe, Bent and his party passed through many of the other stone ruins in the area. Bent even wrote that he added the word great to the name Zimbabwe to distinguish it from all the other smaller Zimbabwes. But the presence of other similar ruins all around southeastern Africa didn't signal to him that Great Zimbabwe was part of a building tradition of the people still living in the area spanning over centuries. He continued to approach Great Zimbabwe specifically as the work of outsiders, drawing comparisons to ancient cities in Malta, Sardinia, and elsewhere in the Mediterranean.
Bent began an excavation that unearthed artifacts that fit right into the context of African archaeology. Weapon points, tools, and pottery were all totally consistent with what should have been expected of a Southeast African civilization.
Bent thought the Zimbabwe birds were meant to represent, quote, the Assyrian Astarte, or Venus, namely the female element in creation. And he found it, quote, obvious that, quote, the ruins and the things in them are not in any way connected with any known African race. The objects of art and special cult are foreign altogether to the country. He concluded that the ruins and the furnaces that were there and the walls were all dedicated to the production and the protection of gold.
Bent's conclusion, quote, a prehistoric race built the ruins, a northern race coming from Arabia, closely akin to the Phoenician and Egyptian, and eventually developing into the more civilized races of the ancient world.
The next effort to study the site was downright damaging from a physical perspective, not just a historical one. Richard Nicklin Hall, a journalist, was appointed as the curator of Great Zimbabwe, and what he was supposed to do was just preserve the structures, not to do further study. Instead, he decided to remove the, quote, filth and decadence of the site's occupation by the local black population, and he removed and discarded stratified archaeological deposits to a depth that ranged from 3 to 12 feet.
He was fired for this. But unfortunately, the damage of his efforts was done at that point. You can't unring that bell. And he didn't even seem to comprehend that anything that he had done was wrong or damaging. He wrote or co-wrote the books The Ancient Ruins of Rhodesia and Great Zimbabwe, and he delivered a lecture at the African Society on October 12, 1904, in which he described what he'd done as, quote, large areas of the ancient temples were cleared of debris to a considerable depth, and the original floors as well as ancient walls and other structures were disclosed, while prehistoric relics were unearthed, which overwhelmingly proved the extensive practice of nature worship of an exceedingly old cult. He went on to express some chagrin that J. Theodore Bent had only seen the ruins in their, quote, buried condition.
He really seems to have genuinely thought that he did the right thing. It was not the right thing.
That's how you do archaeology. You go in with a vacuum and a mop and you take everything away.
This is one of the reasons we didn't have as much to share about what life was like in Great Zimbabwe in the first act of the show today. So many of the archaeological findings that could have told us this were destroyed by a man thinking that he was removing, quote, the filth and decadence of the people who had actually built the place and lived there, thinking it had instead been built by white people and that the actual artifacts were instead a contaminant. Most of the analysis made of the site before the destruction actually happened were also made by people working off of the assumption that what they were looking at was relics from a Phoenician, Egyptian, or Greek civilization that had moved into sub-Saharan Africa, not a sub-Saharan African one. So while there were people who did study of the site before this destruction happened, that study was not archaeologically sound.
Yeah, it was all based on a completely incorrect presumption. But the record was finally set mostly straight, and we're going to talk about that after we first pause for a little sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about Comfort Hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, although Richard Nicklin Hall never seemed to grasp what he had done, the fact that he had done real harm was completely understood by the British South Africa Company, and they then hired David Randall MacIver to investigate. He was an actual archaeologist, and his verdict was that the ruins at Great Zimbabwe, quote, are unquestionably African in every detail and belonging to a period which is fixed by foreign imports as, in general, medieval. So this was in 1905. It was after Europeans had thought that Great Zimbabwe was a biblical city built by someone not from sub-Saharan Africa for hundreds of years, and that it was a Phoenician city built for the Queen of Sheba for decades.
Another English archaeologist, Gertrude Caton Thompson, confirmed Randall MacIver's findings in 1929. And she wrote, quote, "Examination of all the existing evidence gathered from every quarter still can produce not one single item that is not in accordance with the claim of Bantu origin and medieval date. The interest in Zimbabwe and the Allied ruins should, on this account, to all educated people, be enhanced a hundredfold. It enriches, not impoverishes, our wonderment at their remarkable achievement. For the mystery of Zimbabwe is the mystery which lies in the still pulsating heart of native Africa."
The idea that Great Zimbabwe was the work of white people rather than Africans persevered, though. White colonial governments in the region were explicitly racist, and they viewed the black population as inferior and, frankly, incapable of building something like Great Zimbabwe. Talking about its real origins became, at best, a touchy subject.
During the period in which the nation was known as Rhodesia and was governed specifically as a white supremacist state, the government actively tried to suppress discussion of Great Zimbabwe as an African archaeological and historical site built by Africans. Ian Smith, Rhodesia's prime minister, even commissioned a false history to that end.
Eventually, Zimbabwe became an independent nation, with a government that's more representative of its racial demographics. And even so, Great Zimbabwe has continued to face obstacles as a historical site. At various points, people managing the site have undertaken well-meaning but poorly documented attempts to rebuild fallen walls and, you know, other things that naturally happen to hundreds of year old historical sites.
After Great Zimbabwe became a UNESCO World Heritage Site, which happened in 1986, the process of conservation and restoration moved to be much more in line with modern standards. But even so, it's far from a perfect process. The spiritual and cultural significance of the site to the Shona and other Bantu-speaking peoples is sometimes at odds with its status as a historical site. For example, that site is now overseen by the National Museums and Monuments of Zimbabwe, which charges admission, which some view as a desecration or a closing off of a site that used to be open and alive. And the nation of Zimbabwe has had ongoing issues with corruption and hyperinflation. So even though it is a protected site, there is still controversy that sort of broils around it.
Yeah, this is, it's when I started working on this, I knew, because we mentioned it in our episode about Rhodesia, that it was so impressive that, like, the white colonial governments that arrived in the area just assumed that it could not have been built by people actually living there, and instead cited things like Phoenicians or Egyptians, which, just to remind everyone, Egypt is also in Africa. So, like, I already knew that piece of it, but I did not realize until I actually got into researching what had happened that it wasn't so much just people got there and were like, oh, that probably, like, Phoenicians built that. But it was a much bigger effort to classify the site as something that was both not built by sub-Saharan Africans and was related to the Bible. That part was news to me when I got into the episode.
Do you also have some listener mail for us?
I do. This is an email from Mike. It was about the Winchester Mystery House after that part of our Unearthed in 2016 episode where we ticked through some things that we said were really big names, but maybe not totally verifiable.
Yeah.
And we talked about a news article that had come out that we saw in several places, but it all seemed to be referencing the same source, that a new room had been found in the Winchester Mystery House. And so Mike writes, "I've been listening to the podcast for about 2 years now, and I love it. I apologize in advance for such a long email generated by such a short mention on the podcast, but this is something I'm very passionate about. Please feel free to edit as needed if you read it on the air. In one of the recent Unearthed episodes, you quickly mentioned that a new room had been found at the Winchester Mystery House, but admitted that it appeared all the reporting had come from the same initial writing. That's because the initial writing was a press release from the company that owns and runs the tourist attraction. And unfortunately, although it was intended to be tongue-in-cheek, this release was taken quite literally by most news outlets. What the release was actually talking about was a new arcade shooting gallery they built. One of those silly things where you use a light gun, in this case modeled after a Winchester rifle, And when you hit something, the item shakes or a song plays on the piano or a light goes out, etc. And then Mike goes into some personal detail about how he knows this information, which I'm going to skip. We will leave to say he is a credible source. But in the interest of his privacy, I'm not going to go into all that detail. And he says that there is a possibility that there could be, at some point, underneath the mansion, something that had later been filled in and excavated, but that otherwise all of the space within the house itself is accounted for. They're not going to find a mysterious extra room because they know where all of the things are. And then comes on with some other interesting facts, which he says, I also have to tell you that the Mist in History episode about the Winchester House from several years ago fell victim to the fact that 99% of the information out there on the subject is based on gossip and hearsay, even reports that were contemporary to Mrs. Winchester. Mrs. Winchester was not a devoted spiritualist. She may have practiced casually, did not fear that the spirits of those killed by Winchester rifles were after her. She did not build the mansion to appease said spirits. Instead, she was an architectural hobbyist with no training who liked to experiment, and someone who enjoyed employing local people as a form of philanthropy. If you ever wish to revisit the Winchester Mystery House, or if listeners want to look into it, a great resource is Mary Jo Ignoffo's book, Captive of the Labyrinth. Mrs. Ignoffo did extensive research and got all of the raw facts correct, although she occasionally falters when forced to extrapolate in the absence of documentation. For the hardcore local resources, History San Jose is in possession of two collections of photos and documents, one from Mrs. Winchester's ranch foreman and one from her lawyer. These papers reveal Mrs. Winchester to be someone concerned with business and real estate affairs, family, and philanthropy, particularly her interest in keeping her generous giving anonymous. Not so much with seances and spirits in the number 13. I'm not terribly bothered about the false information always given about Sarah Winchester, because without the quirky stories, the mansion probably wouldn't have been saved for posterity. But I also want the truth to get out there. Thanks for providing interesting topics for us with each new podcast. I always look forward to the next one. Sincerely, Mike. Thank you so much, Mike. That is delightful to learn.
Yes.
And I similarly, I've never been to the Winchester Mystery House. But I know it is a very popular attraction. And so I can sympathize with the idea that, that the stories around it were very attractive in having it preserved.
Yeah, for sure.
Even though there is some embellishment going on.
That's not uncommon for historical places. I mean, when we've talked about allegedly haunted places before, mm-hmm. you find out often that the actual story is a little more mundane than what usually, you know, draws people's attention.
Well, and it reminds me a bit of you and I went to Salem, Massachusetts. It was last year at this point. And we filmed some video at the House of the Seven Gables, which you can find on our website. But one of the things that we talk about in that video is how the book, The House of Seven Gables, was based on the house, but the house didn't actually match up what was in the book. So when the house became a tourist attraction to support the work of a settlement house in the area, so it was a charitable effort, some of the work that was done on it brought it more into line with the fictitious representation of it. So it was like a house and then a fiction and then
a slightly renovated house.
A slightly renovated house that still has like a lot of very true and accurate history to talk about, but also has some things that have been added on for the sake of having it be a place that people who are interested in that book would want to come see.
Yeah.
Those are both things that led to preserving a site, not to destroying it, as with Great Zimbabwe. So, if you would like to write to us about this or any other podcast, we're at History Podcast at HowStuffWorks.com. We're also on Facebook at Facebook.com/MissedInHistory and on Twitter at MissedInHistory. Our Tumblr is MissedInHistory.tumblr.com. We're on Pinterest and at Instagram at MissedInHistory. You can come to our parent company's website, which is HowStuffWorks.com, where I think there's a whole thing there about the Winchester Mystery House. And you can come to our website, which is MissedInHistory.com, to find an archive of every episode we've ever done and show notes for the episodes Holly and I have done. That video that we just mentioned from the House of Seven Gables is there, as well as three other videos that Holly and I made after our trip in October. So you can do all of that and a whole lot more at HowStuffWorks.com or MythsAndHistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.